Welcome to the Alien Wellness Think Tank podcast series. The Think Tank is an emergency medicine organization led by residents for residents to improve the culture of wellness during residency training. Take a listen to our conversations with our wellness strategists and mentors.
Hi, everybody. My name is Matt Malamud. I'm one of the faculty mentors at the Wellness Think Tank. We're joined today by a wonderful group of people to speak with Dr. Jason Brooks. He's going to help us speak about some of the performance psychology that we deal with and some things that we can deal with in the emergency room and on shift and off shift. Just to give you a little bit of information about Dr. Brooks, during the past 20 years as a performance coach and consultant, Jason has been collaborating with outstanding performers in diverse fields, from elite athletes to physicians and tactical law enforcement officers, performance artists, and business leaders. Through these consultative relationships, Jason has observed how these individuals develop a unique set of beliefs and practices that equip them to thrive in demanding performance settings. In addition, Jason has extensively researched this phenomenon of high stress, high performance common to physicians and professionals alike, in tandem with his consulting work. Inspired by those experiences, Jason continues to gather and share these lessons with medical professionals, the ultimate goal being to provide them with tools and strategies that can contribute towards enhanced performance and health. Thank you so much, Dr. Brooks, for joining us.
Hey, thank you. My pleasure.
And then I wanted to introduce two wonderful physicians here as well.
So my name is Kuljeet Kaur. I'm a PGY2 resident in a combined emergency medicine and internal medicine residency at Jefferson Health Northeast, so in Northeast Philadelphia, and I love it here.
Yeah. Hi, everyone. My name is Layla. I'm a first-year emergency medicine resident at McMaster, so that's in Hamilton, Canada.
What are some of those things we can do to deal with a high acuity shift that we may come across? And Jason hopefully can fill us in on some interesting ideas or thoughts, techniques, or tactics that we can do to help us along that.
I think as a general rule, what we're talking about is there's sort of three things that we can do. I'm a big believer in readying in advance for certain things that we know could have the potential possibly to hijack our attention and our energy in ways that would not be optimal. We know that there are things coming at you each and every single day. It's a tough performance gig that you work in. We know that uncertainty is absolutely inherent in what you do. If I was to ask anybody here, you know, hey, what's coming through the door in the emerge tomorrow? I don't know. Well, are you going to be able to handle it? I hope so. So the fact that those things are there and there's such a high degree of uncertainty, it helps to gain poise and composure if we can anticipate some of those things, and in particular, our reaction to some of those things, and then perhaps begin to program or create a more optimal one if and when those circumstances were to arise. The second thing that we can do is there will be stuff that catches us off guard. No amount of preparation is going to eliminate new and novel situations. For the rest of your career, on a daily basis, there will be things that you probably have never seen before. So we have to then also be able to recalibrate our focus and our energy in real time. When, not if, when certain things catch us off guard. A complication pops up, there's a challenging interaction with a colleague or with a set of family members or something along those lines. We suffer a less than optimal outcome. And guess what? We don't have a chance to take a timeout or do any deep processing, and we have to somehow summon enough focus and presence of mind to step into the next situation. So being able to recalibrate in real time becomes extremely important. And then the third thing that we can do, what do we do with those experiences afterwards? There's two phases to that. There's in the immediate aftermath, wherein something intense has occurred, and you may not have the luxury of a lot of time to, again, figure out where you're at, what you need, and what you can do to get your wits back to step into the next situation. And then, of course, there is the deeper processing. You're going to deal with outcomes that are really challenging and that fly in the face of every single thing that you are about every single day when you step into that arena. Everybody's there waking up to do good, well, and right for the people that they serve. And sometimes every ounce of doing that doesn't always guarantee that we get the results, obviously, that everybody would want. So we do have to have some mechanism for processing those experiences, drawing lessons from them, and moving forward in some way that we can begin to embrace them as part of our shared experience becoming a physician. And I think those are the three things that we can do. So I would think we'll probably touch on all three of those, but getting ready in advance, resetting our focus and energy during a stressful or intense situation, and then drawing lessons to both process and learn from those challenging situations that, you know, as I say to you, are going to be a daily reality, I'm sure.
Fantastic. So what would be some things I could do before shift, before my day starts, or really before anything I do, that would prepare me for this unknown that I may face every day? Because I really, when I do go on shift, and I'm sure it's the same thing for you guys, I don't know what to expect. I know I'll probably get some chest pains, I'll get some belly pains, I'll get some dizziness, but every day something really bad could come through and I may be completely unprepared for it. So yeah. How could any of us really prepare for that well before we even start?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think there's two ways you could look at that. I mean, if there are specific situational things that you are aware of, so for example, something procedural or dealing with a certain personality perhaps that can be intimidating and distracting, if you are aware of specific situational stressors or events that you know instinctively would have the ability to pull you away from your best performance state, then I would step into those and I would be beginning to engage in, there's all kinds of techniques that we can touch on, but one of the most powerful, I think, in advance, especially to eliminate or to minimize, more effectively minimize some of the anticipatory anxieties, is just to do a bit of guided imagery and rehearsal, which doesn't look a whole heck of a lot different from simulation, which I'm sure many of you do. I toured the sim facilities at McMaster, Layla, so I know you guys are got a tricked out setup down there. And you say to yourself, well, why do we do simulation, right? Because it's to put ourselves in situations that are novel and uncomfortable, such that in a controlled setting, we can be exposed to that level of intensity of stressor and learn an effective response under those conditions. So fortunately, we were blessed with the greatest and most powerful sim center that there is that's housed between your earlobes. And so we can utilize that same system to put ourselves, you know, figuratively speaking, in those situations that we would know have the ability to, you know, overcome us in some way, distracting thoughts and emotions or physiological responses that could interfere with having sufficient awareness to be able to execute in real time. So putting ourselves in those situations, and just the first phase of which I like to describe to people is just allow that scene to play through in your mind as it would naturally go right now. If I was to pluck you and say, Matt, I'm throwing you into that situation, that one thing you just told me causes you some trepidation and is not where you perform at your best, I'm just putting you in there right now. Sorry for no heads up, but sink or swim. So if you were to put yourself there and you were to kind of play that scene through, you'd be able to pick up on all kinds of data going on inside of you. You know, where are my thoughts starting to go? Even the day before, if I'm thinking about the possibility of that situation, right? What am I worrying about? You know, I'm worrying about whether I'm going to have enough skill or enough resources or do something smooth procedurally, or what if there's a complication? What if I don't have the knowledge? So there's all of these thoughts that are permeating in our brain anyways ahead of time. So in the first phase of rehearsal, I'm just gathering that data. What exactly is occurring to me in real time? And I encourage people to look at it as though you were watching yourself from above. So let's use the sim lab as a good illustration. So you're watching yourself perform in the moment, but you're behind the safety glass and you're just taking notes and you look and you go, wow, look at how I start to get flustered there, right? Look at how I can see the moment where my emotions start to get the best of me. The frustration kicks in or the fear kicks in. I can see myself shaking. I can see myself start to get flush. So I'm just making all these observations of the things that are happening inside of me and around me based on my interpretation that are possibly interfering. So it would make sense that becomes the blueprint in essence to sort of inoculate against those kinds of reactions from happening. So when I begin to use more guided imagery rehearsal, I'm playing that situation back in my mind, but I'm triggering in essence the antithesis to all of those sort of unhelpful reactions. So where I start to get flustered, I see and feel myself taking a moment to take a deep breath, bringing that arousal down and anticipating and triggering better focus and better awareness. When the thoughts come up that start to be challenging and self-defeating, I'm shifting my attention towards something that is more constructive. You know, you have algorithms that you utilize every single day for emergency airways and things of that nature. Why wouldn't I have an algorithm that I could shift to in a moment where my internal state of arousal is interfering with my ability to focus, right? So I come up with a little mantra for myself. When I start to feel in that way, I command my attention towards the task, perhaps with an emotional cue, the proverbial wake up to myself, whatever that might be. I mean, you know, be here now or focus or this is important, whatever it might be. Something that takes my attention away from the distracting thoughts and sensations back to the task. That's what algorithms do, right? They're there to protect us from the human factors interfering. What do I do now? Thank heavens I have an algorithm to go by. So in much the same way, doing this guided imagery rehearsal it projects a different expectation in our mind as to how we will respond under certain sets of conditions, primarily ones that have high stress and high uncertainty. Secondly, by virtue of doing so, I'm training my mind through mental repetitions to summon the right response when I need it. And that in and of itself allows me to feel a bit more confidence and a bit more trusting if I was to be in those moments. Because now I don't have to worry about what if that happens, because I have a strategy that says, if that happens, here's how I will respond. So I can exhale. I don't have to fight those moments if they arise. I don't even have to be as fearful of them as I was before. I can accept that they are part of the daily reality of being in this position. And thank heavens, if and when something catches me off guard, I have an expectation as to how I can shift my attention back to something that's constructive. So by virtue of just in a very relaxed setting, going through and playing that scene through and triggering, whether it be with a cue word or a cue image, the attention and the focus I want to bring to this moment right now. And if it's something procedural, let's say, engage all of your senses. I mean, actually be acting out the steps and manipulating the instrument or whatever it might be as you're doing this rehearsal process. You know, as a good colleague of mine and someone who's pretty active in the foam world, Mike Loria, wrote a great piece on dealing with stress in recess situations. And he said, when you do guided imagery rehearsal, your brain doesn't know whether what you're doing is real or just perceived. It just takes all that information as sort of the gospel. And so if you think about it, every time we're secreting a thought to it, we're creating and triggering an expectation as to how the situation could go. And those ones that we feel some degree of trepidation about, if I was to ask you the question, what are the typical thoughts that you have in regards to those situations beforehand and during? Most of them, I'm sure, are ruminating about the parts that you can't control, wishing you had more energy or resources or skill or knowledge or what have you, worrying about whether I have the sufficient ability to handle this stuff. Most of it self-limiting, self-defeating, and certainly self-distracting. So why don't we take advantage for how our neurological system works and begin to imprint an expectation with what we say and how we feel and how we expect to react under certain conditions in a way that's more optimal. And just like anything else, you wanted to get a bigger bicep, the more repetitions you do, it's going to start to adapt. Same as your brain. The more times that we begin to do those mental reps, just seeing and feeling ourselves respond how we want to, again, the brain doesn't know if we've done 50 actual cases like that or the luxury of having done it in our pajamas in our living room while we're half watching Netflix. I mean, it doesn't know the difference. But we're creating and triggering a more optimal response under the conditions. So that's a strategy that I think is highly effective to utilize in advance. And part of that stems from just the awareness, as I said to you, of knowing what it is. What are your triggers? Is it thoughts? Is it feelings? Is it physiological reactions? It's probably some combination of all three. Knowing what I want comes from knowing how I react. Here's how I think I would react. Okay, that's not optimal. Here's what I would rather be projecting. Start doing so. The more practice, the more likely it'll transfer over into the actual moment.
Along the lines you say that, it's funny. When I talk to my residents and when I've talked to a bunch of other people, but one of the procedures that I'm always worried about doing is a cricothyroidotomy, right? So it's one of those things where you don't do frequently, but it's a life-saving procedure if you really need to do it. By not doing it frequently, it makes me more nervous to do it. And when I think about it every day, I think about, all right, well, if somebody comes in right now and I really needed to do it, these are the tools I need. This is how I would do it. This is what I would do if I fail at doing it. And it's actually helped me tremendously. I used to be very, very nervous about going on shift and ever being exposed to this type of procedure that I haven't done one yet.
Yeah.
Despite having finished fellowship, residency, but having walked it through my own head at least probably 15 or 20 or 30 times by now, it's become slightly more comfortable.
Yes.
You know? So, you know, my further question behind that is do you find it easier or do you find it more challenging, or is there anything that really sets apart a person who's younger in their medical career comparatively to somebody who's more senior in their medical career when they come across these thoughts?
Oh, sure. I mean, what you're talking about there as well is just level of skill and expertise also. You know, someone who's very junior, on top of feeling these strong emotions and reactions that, you know, you might typify as stress or stressors, a lot of that's justified because they actually don't have sufficient knowledge, skill, and experience potentially to perform whatever is being tasked to them in a way that would be competent. Someone who has a lot more experience would be able to, at the very least, find elements to be certain about. Okay, I'm not feeling 100% sure about this particular case, but I've had 27 cases that are somewhat similar to some degree. And I feel much more confident perhaps asking people around me. I have stronger connections, stronger relationships. I have a greater database of being in tough and challenging circumstances. All of that creates a bit more leverage over the immensity of that stress. Having said that, none of those things immunize a person from feeling that. You can have the most experienced, clinically sound professional, he or she in a moment they should be able to handle with no problem whatsoever. But let's just say that there's something going on inside of them from a previous case that just occurred that's taking up bandwidth. They're still ruminating about something, or they're carrying over some emotional residue. So across the board, perhaps experience provides us a bit more leverage because we would have more confidence and trust by virtue of it, but it does not immunize. And so I don't think the process changes whatsoever. It becomes probably more tacit the longer you go in your career. You mentioned yourself already, Matt. I mean, here you are through residency, I think is what you said. So you've already figured out a process of doing kind of this imagery and triggering and priming in advance that works for you. You'll continue to do that, I'm sure, for the rest of your career. When people ask you 5 years from now, so Matt, what do you do to get ready for the tough situations? It wouldn't be unexpected that your answer shifts towards, you know, I'm not sure. I just kind of do it. Or, you know, it's just a matter of experience. Eventually you figure it out. Nonsense. You're still engaging in a process that has now become automatic and unconscious, but make no mistake, you're still doing it. And I think the people who I've been around that are the most effective at managing the intensity of a situation do that. They get ready for it early, which provides a bit more equanimity in the moment and also helps to shrink the enormity of it down to something that's at a more manageable scale. I wanted to say something too, Matt, if I could interject. It's so funny. It doesn't sound like we set this up. I assure you we didn't. So one of the best examples I can use as an illustration of utilizing the guided imagery and rehearsal technique was with a surgeon I was working with who he'd said to me one time his biggest fear that was causing him some interference, you know, who knows to what degree, maybe it's 5%, 10%. Bottom line, it was something he knew was getting in the way. There was some focus and awareness that was being consumed by the threat of this thing. And it was having to do an emergency crike. And so in much the same way, he said, you know, I don't want to go my whole career fearing that. And not only that, being distracted by the possibility of that. And he said, much to your point, he said, the procedure itself, especially for someone who he was in ENT, is not, you know, overly technical. He would have enough repetitions doing surgery in and of itself. He says, but it's me, the human being in that moment under pressure when all eyes are on you and it's really time sensitive. You know, can I keep my, you know, what together to be able to execute and prioritize in a way that would be effective? And so he said, you know, I don't have the opportunity to engage in repetitions of doing that, actual ones. So I said, you have something to suggest? I said, yeah. I mean, what's the next best thing to actually simulate it? So he began, much as you described, Matt, in a kind of informal sort of way, just playing around with the idea, doing a bit of rehearsal and projecting a certain type of response during idle times in his day, or eventually it became something that was part of his daily preparation. So taking 2 or 3 minutes in the morning just to again, go through that scenario, if it was to happen, here's how I might be feeling. Here's what I would need to do to shift my attention back. Here are the essential steps or what have you. And he just started to play with that. And he called me sometime after, let's say 8 months, and he was doing a fellowship. And he said, you're not going to believe this, but it happened. I said, you're kidding me. He said, yeah. I said, how'd you respond? He said, exactly as though I had programmed in my mind 700 times or 300 times or whatever it had been at that point. You know, he said there was just the cues were so automated at that particular point in time. I just went into performance mode. And he said, so I very calmly, he said, and interesting, even what the anesthetist said to him, he said, even that was precisely how I had envisioned it. It was just going to be at the last second someone says, I've lost it. And that would be the cue for him to have to stop what he was doing and swing in. So anyways, he performs the procedure. It goes fine. And he says, it wasn't until I was finished and I sort of stepped back and then kind of regained more situation awareness. He said, and to see the looks on people's faces, it was crazy. I mean, they're all sitting there with their jaws on the ground because they can't believe how cool, calm, and collected this young professional was. I mean, he was just starting fellowship at this time. And he said, it's interesting. He says, it wasn't to do with that in so much. It was more my mind and my body knew what to do because it had been practiced and rehearsed, and that expectation was primed so many times. You know, there's a very famous quote from martial artist Bruce Lee. He talks about when you get to a certain point of development, he says, you know, because I've simulated and rehearsed doing these things so many times, he says, you get into the performance moment and he says, I don't kick or punch. It kicks or punches itself. I mean, it becomes automatic. And so again, by virtue of investing a small amount of time on a daily basis, or if you have some heads up for something that's coming your way that might be aligned with one of those scenarios that could otherwise take you away in ways that would not be helpful, what an opportune time to engage in a 2-minute priming exercise, just to remind and to cue your brain as to what will be important, to be aware of the kinds of physiological and emotional reactions you might be experiencing, and then to have a mechanism to shift away from that, to bring that arousal down, which frees awareness and capacity to perform at my potential. In much the same way as we fear those situations right now, that fear has been created by what we have thought and projected in our mind about being in that circumstance, right? So let's take advantage of the very same way in which our brain is hardwired, but now let's start projecting an expectation that's more consistent with how we would want to feel. Tell it what you want. And with repetition and practice, it'll start to execute in that way.
Cool, Jade or Layla, have you guys come across any particular recent events that had you wished you would have done this, it may have helped you along?
Yeah, there's one scenario that I can think of. So we had a really difficult intubation. Mm-hmm. Basically, the patient was having like tons of hemoptysis, came to the point where couldn't manage the airway anymore. So we went and intubated. It was one that I ended up needing staff help for because it was such a difficult airway. We ended up needing a surgery to go and try that. And then the next intubation I had actually wasn't that difficult, but I had to like recenter, kind of go through it in my mind before actually going through the process of actually intubating because I needed to get that previous experience out of my head.
Yes.
I actually had a situation where I had a pediatric code and it didn't work out well. And I think that kind of, I don't want to say scarred me, but it definitely like brought me back and I had to kind of reflect on it. And then next time I had a kid come in who was like a pediatric patient with anaphylaxis, I felt myself get really stressed at first, just thinking about how the other one worked out. But then I kind of collected myself just because there's parents there and, you know, you want to be calm and collected, especially in front of them as well. Otherwise, they're already so worried. And I think taking a step back and just making sure everything was in order. We got the pediatric code cart by the room and we're prepared in whichever circumstance the situation would have gone. And I think just stepping back in that moment was good for me because I did feel myself get very stressed at first. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'd like to drill even deeper with both of you. So let's just start with you, Kolji, because I think it's so powerful what you're illustrating. Again, whether these techniques have been formally taught to people, they become something you learn through osmosis in your field of work because you need to. So you came off of something that was highly intense, right? And the outcome was less than optimal, to put it mildly. I mean, you're reeling to some degree. You'd use the word scarred, I think, from that experience. So that's the state that you are in. And somehow magically, by virtue of being a physician, you are to somehow suspend or put aside all of that internal arousal to be fully focused for the next most important case, which obviously they would need and want your full composure and full presence of mind for. And you kind of alluded to the fact that you stepped back and just kind of put it aside. But if you were to reflect deeper, is there something specific that you did? Like, was there a certain image? Was there a certain word? Was there a certain experience that you drew on that helped you sort of here and now? Because again, think of how the state of emotion that you were in. So you had to go from that to something that was completely minimized in terms of its intensity. What was it that allowed you to shift your attention? Because if you master this, Kuljeet, you're golden. Because in every one of those situations, what we're really talking about here is how do I shift my attention? My attention is a certain kind of way, highly emotional, highly distracted about what just occurred. Not the perfect set of conditions to perform in that next case. I have to shift my attention away from that towards something that's more here now. What was it that you did?
It's kind of hard for me to pinpoint exactly what it was because I feel like there was so much going on at once. I think one thing that helped kind of move me forward in that situation was that I realized as the parents were taking this anaphylactic kid back to the room, I realized he was still protecting his airway. And I think to me, that was like, okay, so I wasn't even at the point where we were with the previous patient. So I think that to me was calming. And I was like, okay, I feel better about this. And I was able to kind of compose myself at that point. But I don't know if it was like a certain thought that hit me at that moment. I honestly am having a hard time pinpointing that. But I think it was the fact that I knew that I had time to kind of get on top of things.
Well, you did two things by taking sort of a mental reset for yourself. Whether if we could look at the amount of time that it was probably short. I mean, whether it was 5 seconds or 30 seconds or whatever it was, just by virtue of stepping back and allowing a bit of space between what just occurred and before what you had to immerse into coming next, bringing a little bit of that arousal down it and recuperating a little bit of energy, right? A little bit of perspective moment. And then secondly, most likely, and again, unconsciously, the fact of the matter is that that next situation commanded your attention, doesn't it? I mean, you have no choice in essence, but to be able to shift. And so there's probably one of the best ways to shift attention, especially in a moment, you know, coming off something that you just described and have to be zeroed in for something else that's about to occur. One of the best ways to do that is through emotion. So there was probably some deeper emotion, not to compare in terms of what you were feeling as far as grieving or feeling unfortunate about what occurred, but I say deeper, I mean a stronger signal that said, in spite of that, Kuljeet, we need you here now. So maybe it's a little bit of fear of not being prepared enough for that current moment that makes you go, whoa, that's not acceptable. I got to step back. I got to be ready right now. There's some inner voice that just said, this requires all of me. And that kind of scares us and snaps us back in focus. So it's interesting that the kryptonite, if you will, to transition from a highly emotional experience was also emotion, but in a way that captured our attention and brought it here and now. So in much the same way, that's why I'm a big believer in having little mantras or little cue techniques that people can utilize where, okay, something challenging has occurred. It's been quite intense for me. I don't have the ability to process that to a heightened degree right now. And I absolutely have to step into the next set of circumstances and be focused. I have to command that attention. So for some people, it's just recognizing that what happened was unfortunate. I will have to do some deeper processing later, but here's the most important thing right now. And you have some keyword, you know, be here now, stay focused, what have you. Even for people who are stepping into something intense, there was a great exchange on Twitter a couple of weeks ago with some Emerge docs that I'm affiliated with. And they were sharing their strategies or their little cue techniques for when they're stepping into something. So say it's like you had mentioned earlier, Matt, all of a sudden you got to do an emergency crake. You can appreciate in that moment the rush of emotion, right? Which could be highly interfering and that's going to cascade over and become a physiological response. So now potentially we're having to do this very delicate procedure and my hands are shaking and sweating. I mean, not the perfect complement. And so in that moment, they have trained themselves to recognize what they're experiencing. They're not going to pretend that they're feeling anything other than that level of intensity. But they also know that's not going to be suitable for right now. So they have a little mantra that they use that is, it's an emotional cue and it's also an instructional cue. And so, for example, one of them was, okay, this is going to be challenging. I've been in challenging situations before. You know, my task is to be here now and perform as I can. Something along those lines. Or, you know, I've got plenty of support here. Whatever it is, it just becomes that thing where in a moment where we're heightened in a way that could be distracting, that's what I turn to. That's the algorithm. And by virtue of doing so and saying that with a little bit of emotional intensity, it snaps my attention back to the here and now, away from the distracting and worrisome thoughts and emotions towards, as best as I can, present focus, full awareness. Because if I do that for myself, at the very least, I've put myself in position to get the best possible outcome. Because if I am of the best state of awareness and focus, then that's what's going to allow me to summon everything that's inside me that would be important in this situation. So it's very interesting how, again, you may not know specifically what you did, but instinctively there was some emotional shift from heightened emotion to a different emotion that said, got to be here now. You've mastered this already, Kuljeet. Why are you being on?
I don't think I mastered it. I need to pinpoint what it was and work on it.
Yeah. Well, it's fantastic. And going back to you as well, Layla, in that situation, again, you're coming off of something that by your own standards, you know, you didn't feel as a solid a performance as you would have liked. And lo and behold, the medical gods heard you. So what did they do? Provided the very next moment an opportunity to do the same thing when you were still carrying over some distractive elements from the previous one. And so somehow, some way, you were able to put aside the distracting thoughts and emotions to be more fully present here. similar questioning. What is it that you think that you did?
So we actually talked about this as a resident group a couple of weeks ago at a retreat. And one of the techniques that was brought up was when you go into these situations that you haven't done well on before, just picturing yourself succeeding at it and what the steps you would do to succeed. So when I went into that next scenario and I said, okay, I have to intubate this patient and I'm going to do it and it's going to be successful. And I just pictured myself like the tube passing through and that's how I went forward with that, with just the thought process that it was going to be successful.
Yeah.
And by doing that, I felt like I was able to go through it systematically rather than having all these thoughts and emotions going around and saying, this is what happened last time. It was a bit more of a clean slate. Absolutely. Definitely something I need to work on because it wasn't perfect. It still took me a few seconds to get those thoughts out of my head and think that way. But it was a helpful technique.
Well, absolutely, because in the moment, what it allowed you to do is it took your focus away from the extraneous stuff and purely on the task. You know, you broke it down. This is a set of steps that follow a certain pattern of sequencing. And if I focus my attention on the steps, I have full awareness to be able to detect, you know, the nuances in terms of the anatomy and how it's feeling, whatever I'm doing this procedure, that's the best place for me to be. If I'm still consumed by those thoughts, I'm going to miss some of that information here and now.
Yeah.
So again, for you, it seems like it was emotion again, like you traded, if you will, or you drowned out that sense of negativity and that sense of poor performance or that sense of falling short of what you would have wanted and saying, okay, if I carry that into here, that's not going to make this task any easier. What is some sort of an emotional cue that's sort of equal and opposite that if you put them on a scale, just allows me to be even? You know, I don't think you were sitting there saying to yourself, I'm going to do the greatest performance of this technique that the world has ever seen. No, you're not saying that. I mean, for you, good was going to be good enough. Like I can see this being successful. And I like that strategy. I think as well, because there are times where we won't be successful by virtue of anything we could or could not have done. And so to add to that, I also encourage people more so just to begin to rehearse the response to a reaction that they want. So for example, I'm in a moment, oh my gosh, I start to get taken aback, or I just stepped out of a procedural thing where I don't feel all that great about how I did. How would you be experiencing that? You know, what would you be feeling? Ah, you know, maybe a little guilty, a little bit of shame, a little bit of embarrassment, angry at myself. I mean, any one of those emotions or all of them, I'm sure would apply. And so you say, okay, I need to be able to shift my response to that reaction. I can't pretend I'm not going to have that reaction. I will for the rest of my career. But much like you realize, I can't take that over into this next moment. So you found a way to develop a better response to what would be a distracting reaction. So you converted that energy into something that then summoned focus and presence, which served you well.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Because sometimes even the easy things just become so difficult when you're not able to refocus and have that positive mindset going into something.
Yeah, absolutely.
Awesome.
And again, there's nothing about one's experience or knowledge or skill that would effectively immunize us from feeling that way. I mean, if you're at the end of a shift and you've had some crazy recesses, and I don't care if you have 20 years experience or your first year resident, there'll be times where it's tough to perform the way that we know that we can if our state has been compromised in such a way.
Do you find when we have a trying case, be it somebody, we couldn't save the patient, you know, especially pediatric codes are probably one of the most trying of cases, and especially when they pass, but yet there's still a full ED waiting for us to go and go see the 56-year-old with chest pain after this pediatric patient, for example, passed away. We say our mantra, we put ourselves back into our mindset and get ourselves going. By doing that, do you find that they lose the ability to really process that moment? And does that moment kind of come back and get at them? Yeah. Does it create angst or does it create depression or anger? And how can you balance the moment where you're trying to move on to the next person who really needs your attention at this moment, be it really sick or not sick? And I'm sure all of us have taken that 1 or 2 minutes to kind of decompress, but is that really truly enough? And since it may not be, how can we kind of cope with that? How can I deal with that in a later time?
It's a great question, Matt. I mean, that becomes a survival skill and there's a lot of layers there. And I would say, first off, the most effective way to approach that, I mean, to have a chance to be able to compartmentalize would be if there was a commitment to myself, then when I say compartmentalize, I mean for the time being, but make no mistake, I will make time. I don't care how tired I am at the end of the day, at the end of my shift, or if there's some window to engage with the team for 30 seconds, 2 minutes, 5 minutes, whatever. If there's an opportunity for me to disappear in the background and emote a little bit because I am human and nothing in my training made me unhuman. If there's some opportunity to express and feel that moment, take advantage. But absolutely, and it cannot be just something we say to ourselves. We have to be able to step back into that at the end of a shift and find a way to process it, you know, to draw the lessons that were important, to figure out how we could have been better in that same situation next time. It's very interesting because I've been working in medicine now for over 10 years, like extensively, not exclusively, but extensively. And it's sort of been a side interest of mine to ask as many physicians as possible precisely what they do to deal with what you just described, because it just seems to me that it's so absent in the training. For some reason, we would expect that by virtue of having a high degree of medical knowledge, somehow, some way, that is supposed to mean that equally in those very human moments, they're not supposed to affect us in ways that they would normally. Of course they do. And so if we don't process those, you can think of it in terms of a pressure cooker. Eventually, over time, things will happen, and they may even be unconscious, that will be problematic. You know, we might lose empathy. You know, we might start to develop compassion fatigue. You know, we might start to feel burned out and depressed and what have you. And those things just cascade. And then equally, in each of the cases that, you know, Lila Kuljeet mentioned, if we didn't have a mechanism of stepping into that next moment effectively and just carried that intensity over time, that could affect our ability in similar situations next time. You know, if it was a pediatric case, for example, I don't want to be preloaded to have a fear of pediatric cases when I could have five in a row, right? Or I might not see one for 2 months. I mean, who's to say? But there has to be some follow-through processing, and it can't just be lip service. You must engage with it. And so I'll explain a process. I mean, I think that there's two levels here that are very important. There is the micro debrief or eventing that can occur at the end of a recess. And I've had many conversations with eMERGE docs about this too. And they say, well, it doesn't seem like there's a lot of time. I say, well, is there any time? Like I said to you, is it more about being oriented to capitalize on whatever amount of time is available? If you had 12 seconds and you looked across the room at your team and you could see that most everybody's feeling what you're feeling, if you were oriented to receive that moment in 12 seconds, you could probably say something or start something that would be helpful for that team. Appreciate everybody's effort. You know, thank you for staying in this thing. Let's honor this person by making sure that we step into the next moment ready to go, whatever it might be. And I think, so anyways, that's the micro thing, is to take a moment for yourself, and however you can define a moment and whatever amount of time is available in that moment. But secondly, the more deeper processing. And one of the physicians I work with, he said, we have an ethical obligation to do that processing. Forget at a human level, just in terms of how it would make us feel, which is important. You have an ethical obligation to every single patient that comes after you to step into that experience, to be able to process the emotion. If we don't process it, it's going to grow, and it's going to grow underneath the surface in ways that we can't see. You know, all of a sudden, again, we become more disenfranchised. We become more angry. We become more distant, whatever it might be. Process that emotion. In doing so, there's a cathartic effect, and it begins to let go some of that intensity. As we process the emotion, we're in a much better state then to engage in the more intellectual analyses of what occurred. It would make sense that I would want to step into that and figure out, okay, what could we have done differently? What would have mattered? And secondly, what will I do differently under the same circumstances next time? If we extract learning from a very challenging and difficult outcome, you say to yourself, well, what's the most important thing that we could do to honor that experience? I want to honor the fact that this person has had this outcome. How do I do that? I can't bring them back. I'm going to make sure that I learn as much as I possibly can to be better and to share that with as many people as I can, as a mentor, as a teacher, as a colleague. And so if I process the emotion, if I draw as many lessons as I can and I share those widely, what else can we do? What else can we do? That's what we can do. You know, we will never forget those experiences, and you would never want to, because some people channel those experiences as extra focus and extra energy. It's like, I'm low. Geez, I don't know if I have enough energy to sign my name on this rec form, let alone this crazy recess that's coming. And they think back to some of those experiences, and guess what happens to their energy level? It goes through the roof. So another way that you can honor that experience. These opportunities provide us the chance to practice important virtues like patience and empathy and forgiveness of ourselves and potentially of our team. You know, and if we're carrying that residue over, it begs the question, who will suffer the most? You will suffer immensely, but odds are your patients will too. And so there's many things that we need to do, both in the immediate aftermath and the deeper processing that has to follow. And, you know, one of my favorite articles, I think it's rooted in surgery. It was by an author named Shelley Liu. It's a medical article. And the essence is waking up the next morning after a critical incident. And they interviewed some surgeons who'd been through it. And it's a qualitative research piece, which I like. They identified sort of a four-phase model of what it's like. And it's like the kick, you know, like just, ugh, your reality seems turned upside down. I mean, this awful outcome occurred that nobody in the right mind would ever step into the day expecting. And again, not much in my training to help me deal effectively with that. So there's just this visceral reaction to it, you know, laced with shame and guilt and all the things that would be expected. Then there's the fall that begins to spiral. You know, I start to doubt myself and beat myself up and what have you. And then once we do that, now we sort of get into the recovery and moving forward phase. But it was so interesting to see because, again, this is rooted in surgery. You could take anywhere it says surgeon, you could substitute with emergency medicine physician, an anesthesiologist, any other performance setting in medicine, it's the exact same. At the human level, the way in which those critical incidents and those difficult outcomes make us feel, that's the part that we need to process to be able to step back in there with renewed purpose, with continuous sense of meaning, and to avoid some of the detrimental effects otherwise that would spin into burnout and dissatisfaction and fear.
Have you seen any benefit or detriment behind having an immediate debrief comparatively to a debrief at the end of the shift?
Yeah.
Because we all want to take a few minutes and debrief quickly and say, hey, everyone, we tried what we could, but unfortunately we had a bad outcome from it. We have to go out and see our patients. Or can I say to everyone, thank you so much. Let's go back out and see the patients. And then, you know, at the end of the shift, kind of turn back and say the same thing. Am I missing something by waiting?
Yeah. And it's interesting. I mean, instinctively, the answer would be, of course. I mean, if you can engage in, especially something that was quite intense, if you can engage in some initial debriefing, you might be able to help people begin. Like there's a preliminary degree of processing that can occur that might accelerate their ability to naturally be able to compartmentalize and step into the next moment, right? If they're trying to do that and fighting it the whole time, like, I know I should feel this way, but gosh, that was really scared and awful. I just want to have it to some degree normalized for me in front of the group. I'm pretty sure we're all feeling that thing. I think there's tremendous value in doing it right away. And it's very interesting. There's even research on PTSD that suggests that when someone has had a very traumatic experience, I'll give you a good example. I saw this just recently. I was watching a surfing documentary, a very famous surfer, Laird Hamilton. He's a big wave surfer. And he was being towed out to a wave with a partner, and they suffered a massive wipeout, 100-foot wave. And they're getting hamburgered as this wave is just ripping them apart. And so they get to the shore, and his friend is in really rough shape. You know, he's got some significant lacerations. They call it medevac, rescue, all the rest. So he's describing this, and he puts him on the helicopter. And I'm assuming it's like, well, that was the end of his surf day. I'm waiting for the next moment for him to say how, you know, and then I took him to the hospital, and he's like, no. He says, so I load him on the helicopter. He says, and then I looked at another guy who had joined us, and I said, let's go back out there. And I thought, you got to be kidding me. And he said, no. He said, listen, I wasn't doing this because I wasn't sympathetic to what my friend was going through. He said, I had been in too many conversations with former big wave surfers where the one wave that made them not go back out again. And he said, my fear was if I don't, you know, the proverbial get back on the horse, maybe that starts to creep in to some degree. And I can, maybe in essence, I could begin to prevent that from happening by minimizing the potential to step right back into it. And so I think for post something critical, such as you've described, to be able to engage in a little bit of that processing such that there's been some degree of release and understanding probably allows me to step into that next moment more fully and without fearing intense moments like that again.
That's what I always thought. I think if we can make that effort, and I think that's one of the biggest challenges of emergency medicine, is that we sometimes don't have that opportunity. And if we do, and if we make that opportunity to really debrief for those few seconds, that'd be the most beneficial thing for all of us. And I think we'd all really benefit from it.
And just do that too, Matt. I mean, you say to yourself again, are we going to have the luxury of being able to, you know, to all go down to Starbucks and sit down and talk for 40 minutes. No, I mean, you might have 30 seconds, you might have 2 minutes, you might not have any time. But I think what becomes important, and some of the physicians that I work with here locally or have been around, they have made it. They have just made it a practice that whatever amount of time that we have, I'm going to ensure that we at least engage in something, something that allows us to free up a little bit of emotional capacity, shall we say, and by extension, a bit more awareness and focus to be able to transition into this next performance moment that is equally important. And so again, just by virtue of being aware and taking advantage of whatever amount of time I have, so as I don't have to think about what I should say, it's like, as soon as it happens, I already know, okay, we got 30 seconds. Here's what I can accomplish in 30 seconds that would be helpful. If we had 2 minutes, I might be able to go a little bit deeper. If we had 4 minutes, I could go even deeper. But even in 30 seconds, is there something that we could do right now that at the very least would provide a little bit of a collective exhale to be go, okay, I think now I can step back into this next moment. I still got a lot of processing to do, but I've freed up enough, you know, emotional capacity to step into this next moment. And great leaders do that, and they do it well.
I just want to say that I completely agree with the benefits of having a debriefing immediately after the event. I say that because after that pediatric code, the hospital had scheduled a debriefing, but it was scheduled for like a week after. At the bedside, there were, you know, trauma surgery was there, anesthesia was there, emergency room was there, respiratory therapists, orderlies, nurses, techs, everyone were there. I was on an internal med rotation by the time the debriefing happened, and I wasn't able to go to the debriefing. And whoever was working on the shift probably couldn't go to the debriefing as well. Yeah. So I'm not even sure who all was able to go. Since there were so many departments there and so many members, I think everyone could have benefited from having it right there. So I just want to say I completely agree with taking that time right after the event just to kind of organize.
You know, that's such an important point because that moment is a shared experience. The only people who understand what it was like are the people who were in that room at that time. So it makes sense that collectively, if we could share in the processing of it and share in the normalizing of it, there's strength in numbers. We feel more supported and understood, which again might allow us to a bit more quickly and a bit more effectively transition into that next performance moment. And it's just so important that we do that. And I should mention too, there's a colleague, he'd be a colleague of yours, someone I've got to know, an eMERGE doc from Wisconsin, named Dr. David Hindle. Fantastic guy, really brilliant mind when it comes to the performance aspect side of things too. And he was telling me, he says, you know, it's very interesting that we have systems set up, say like M&M rounds, to debrief the critical incidents. And he says, you know, we have to do that because we have to draw lessons from failure and from poor outcomes to be able to change systems and change training and change processes to make for a safer, healthier system. He says, absolutely important. But a colleague of his who's a researcher in the UK started looking at this phenomenon. He said, you know, across most every single medical specialty, if not all of them, if you were to put it on a chart, the instances where the actions of people, so let's say in your group in eMERGE, contributed to a positive and or successful outcome, however you would define that, okay? Doesn't mean necessarily, you know, that the person survived, but, you know, we did everything that we could and we did it well and something happened that couldn't have been prevented. So he said the vast majority, like it's ridiculous how high the percentage of times would be, quote unquote, where we do it well. But we only have this platform, this avenue to really dissect when things don't go well. So if we're successful 80% of the time, let's just say for argument's sake, why are we not also stepping into those experiences to figure out how and why we were successful? Why wouldn't we have a 5-minute debrief at the end of a really challenging recess where we took a super difficult situation and made something positive out of it? We got the right outcome. We came together. You know, why was that? You know, maybe it was because there was great communication or there was great teamwork or people were focused and people took initiative. It's like, why are we not also extracting that information in the times when things went well? And if 80% of the time, for argument's sake, they do, and we're debriefing and reinforcing outcomes 80% of the time that remind us, there's a lot of evidence to support trusting our abilities and trusting in our performance level to do the job right when we need to. Imagine what that reinforcement does internally, again, to create an even deeper level of trust and confidence in our ability to perform well in this role. But we don't do that.
Awesome. One of the other things I wanted to kind of discuss a little bit further was, besides the difficult patient or the difficult scenario that we may come across, How do we deal with our difficult colleagues or consultants? We have pretty decent control of our patients. We can say, like, this is how we're going to do it. This is how we're going to approach it. But when we have to work with our colleagues day in and day out, what are some mechanisms that I can utilize to deal with somebody who, for example, they may be having a really rough time as well, and it's just kind of coming back to me, or I have to deal with them day in and day out for the rest of my residency or ER career.
Yeah.
Is there anything that you would do typically, or you would recommend somebody to do?
Absolutely. I mean, fortunately, there's no strong personalities in medicine though, right? So you don't even have to worry. No, they're there. They're in every performance setting. And I think something you brought up there, which is really important too, Matt, because part of the strategy or the tool, if you will, especially if you have a chance to get to know people a little bit, is to be able to differentiate between someone who is just that way versus, wow, someone who's obviously having a bad day. You know, if it's atypical behavior of that person, it makes it a little bit easier for us to quote unquote give them a pass or to not take as much of what they're saying and how they're saying it to heart. Like, we can appreciate it. Matt's like this 5 days a week. I saw him today and he was all over the place. You know, I'm more concerned about Matt in that situation than I am about, you know, what Matt said to me. So that's important. I mean, if you have that advanced knowledge. But if you don't, the strategy almost is identical to what we talked about earlier is, if there are certain personalities or certain situations where I shrink down by virtue of the way in which someone is approaching me or dismissing me or being demeaning to me, it's like, you know, kind of the classic pimping, if you will. I have to control what I can control. So the first question is, what can I control? Can I control their behavior and or their personality flaw? No, I can't. In certain circumstances, if it was dismissive and demeaning enough, I have to be ready to challenge them. I mean, there would be a threshold beyond which, let's say, pimping or that type of thing becomes something that is bullying, perhaps. So I have to be able to differentiate what's the difference, and I have to be ready to respond to protect me and my area if and when it goes past that. If it is just the typical level of pimping that people are accustomed to, that nobody likes it, but you come to expect it with certain personalities, you got to say to yourself, what is the part I can control? I cannot control that they are going to do that. I have to make this a lesson in professionalism. I have to have a goal. Like, a goal is something that pulls us in a direction. Like, there's a magnetic pull to it. I want it to be my goal that I do not compound this issue further by giving away my energy in the way that I react to them. They are the way that they are. I cannot change that. I will not allow them to take me away from how I want to feel and focus. And so it becomes almost a challenge to myself. Forget them. This isn't even about them. It's about me. Can I control my reaction? So I'm rehearsing, seeing myself respond with poise. There might be some image that you use that, you know, shrinks them down. There was one, a physician I know that saw, he said, oh, this one person who caused him to feel that way. He said, you're reminding me so much of Ron Burgundy from Anchorman. Like, he just had that personality. And he started to laugh as he said that. And then he instinctively knew, it's like, huh, as he would see that person berating him in what way, you know, in his mind, he saw a Ron Burgundy face and the mannerisms. And guess what? All of a sudden, it shrunk the intensity of it down a little bit, because now there's something about it that's actually kind of funny. And it's like, is that a disrespectful way to do it? I'm going to tell you this. What works is what works. If what's most important is to protect your energy and your focus and your reaction in that moment, and if you can paint that person in a certain kind of light that allows you to do that more effectively, you do that. Whatever works is what works. But anyways, to make it a goal as I'm engaging in a bit of rehearsal in those situations, to see and feel myself protecting my energy by virtue of how I respond to what they are saying. That's the control that I have. And it's very interesting because this always gets into a dialogue around alpha personalities or just even the alpha mentality, whether we're talking about in wildlife. And you go, what is it that separates an alpha? Well, the alpha gets what they want, don't they? So you say to yourself, in that situation, if I can't change that person's behavior, ultimately, what is it that I want? Well, I don't want to make my situation worse by allowing them to make me feel in ways that are precisely what they're trying to do. I don't want to feel small. I don't want to feel insignificant. I don't want to feel myself shaking and angry and frustrated, whatever. I don't want that. So by virtue of me working on me and triggering that type of response, you know, seeing as an opportunity to be a professional, seeing as an opportunity to set a goal for myself to achieve and make it a challenge. And if you begin to be in that situation and feel less reactive, who is the alpha? You are. Why? Because you get what you want. And part of how I do that as well, there's basic communication techniques. So in that same situation, I'm starting with the very end that I want in mind. I want to gain knowledge from that person, and I want to make sure that I don't react. So I'm not going to give off any of the typical kinds of nonverbal behaviors or whatever that I would normally do that A, would allow them to see that what they're doing is having an effect, or B, that would signal to me a diminishing of my own personal power and control. I'm not going to do that. Start with the end in mind. Check your state. As you're doing a procedure and you know you're going to get some feedback from that person, as soon as I'm done, I'm going to take a deep breath for myself just to kind of brace myself for the inevitable. It's like, hey, maybe today's the day that they provide that real positive feedback. No, it's probably not. You'd be better served readying for the same type of feedback and same style as you've been accustomed for. Because if I can inoculate myself from that and then you start being positive, why don't you be ready for that? That's pretty easy to deal with. It's the dismissive, demeaning part. And I think as well, another part of that is a perspective on that. When you say, okay, if I'm going to start viewing that as an opportunity to practice professionalism, I'm going to start doing that as a goal, a challenge to myself to create. Why would I want to do that? Because here's the thing. That situation could potentially be a safety risk. There could be a patient safety risk attached to someone else shifting your attention away from the task or what we're doing here towards half doing that and half angry or frustrated about what they said or how they said it to you. That made me more susceptible to an error in the very next thing that I do. So I have an obligation to this patient. So all of a sudden you go, wow, then it really isn't about me, is it? No, it's not. The challenge here is also about ensuring that as a professional, I'm delivering the utmost care to the thing that matters the most, providing that to this patient and their family. If I allow myself to be distracted by someone who's either purposely trying to do so or is just having a bad day, it's no longer on them. That's on me. As a professional, I want to create an internal response to that that protects me from that possibility, because that's the professional that I want to be.
Totally. That's fantastic. That's a huge point, because I think we're all going to come across these people who, yeah, in essence, their personality or their energy is just going to suck it away from you. And, yeah, and if you don't let them, I think that's a huge plus. You'll just focus much more on your patient and the matters at hand that really matter comparatively to somebody just either having their own bad day or just being kind of a difficult person to begin with.
Is the added value too, Matt? Like as you begin to do that and create that expectation for yourself, as that begins to manifest in your actual experience, all of a sudden, let's say there was one person in particular that your stomach would be in knots 2 days beforehand when you knew that you were working with them, right? All of a sudden, you're less reactive in their presence. What do you think that does for your own degree of confidence and trust? What do you think that does to your point, to my ability to be more fully focused and aware and perform it at the level that I can perform at? I mean, all of those measures improve exponentially. And the beauty is, guess what? The person didn't change. That person didn't go to behavior therapy class and become a bit more touchy-feely. They didn't change at all. I adapted to this aversive stimulus in my performance environment. I adapted to it in a way that protects me. Congratulations. That's an even greater victory.
Awesome.
I really appreciate how it really seemed like there's thought exercises that you can go through both before and after all these difficult encounters. Really something that I want to try implementing, because I think it really matters, you know, what mindset you're in when you're coming into these situations, but also coming out of them.
Absolutely.
And it really affects how you move forward and how you go on to the next thing. So actually having a concrete thought exercise saying, okay, I'm going to think about this and I'm going to refocus this way, or I'm going to debrief with these people, makes it so much more systematic and easier to approach. So I really appreciate that. Yeah.
Well, thank you. I would add one thing to that too, again, that takes that idea of having something systematic to the next level. So I'm a big believer in reflective practice. So if you've had a chance, say, to debrief with the team, whether it be immediately after an intense situation or like you were saying, Matt, if there was some time at the end of a shift or whatever to do that, that's great. But then there's the individual processing that has to occur as well. And if we're like most highly motivated professionals that I've been around, particularly in medicine, if we've had a shift where, again, we did most of the things well or to standard, but there were a few moments, a few outcomes, a few performance situations where I'm reeling from that. I wished I would have done something different. I wish we would have had a different result. Ask yourself, which of those two experiences are you carrying home with you and perseverating on the most, right? The 20% of things that didn't go well, not the 80 that did. And so again, you think of what kind of perception that creates in our mind. If all I'm doing is reminding myself that there were many moments where I didn't cut the mustard, I didn't perform the standard. I mean, it'd be very easy for that to begin to morph into, I'm not good enough, this is too tough, and on it goes. And so if we had a bit more balanced airtime, we absolutely want to step into those moments where we need to get better, for sure. But we must also ensure that we're reflecting on the bigger picture, which is, and what about the stuff that I did that was well? You know, for example, in your situation, you went from a challenging procedural thing to the exact same procedural thing. It would have been very easy and understandable if that second performance was worse than the first. So that's a victory that you were able to get yourself together, collect your bearings, shift your emotional state so that you had focus there. How much time did you allow yourself to think about that at the end of that experience?
Not much time.
Yeah. You know, and so I like the idea of, in some of the other fields I work in, say I do some work with a tactical support team here for police officers, SWAT team. And so they do what's called an AAR, after action review. And for that very reason, it's to put a structure to the personal or the individual debriefing such that we don't just ruminate on the stuff that didn't go well, that it's more balanced. So we look at the totality of the day and say, okay, here's what went well. Here's what did not go well. I need to get better at. How do I get better at that? Who can help? And what can I do to envision or perform better in the same circumstances next time? Now, that's something that still acknowledges the part that we'd be perseverating on. We're stepping into the stuff that didn't go well, but we're also then ensuring that we remind ourselves that there were things that we were quite capable and competent at. And secondly, most important, I'm extracting information and applying it to be better in each of those situations next time. Again, how do we honor the cases that we had? By learning, by applying, and by growing and going forward. And if we don't include those other two elements, and all we do is spin the bad stuff at the end of the day, oftentimes that spinning of it doesn't lead to anything constructive. It's just like we spin it until we get exhausted, and then we finally fall asleep and we still feel terrible about it. It's like there's been no learning. There's been no processing. And day by day, if that's where our attention goes, it's creating this expectation, and the stress and the strain and the fear and what have you can begin to mount. So having a structured, systematic way of processing our experiences, it forces us to consider the good, the bad, and how we get better. That's helpful.
Definitely. That was great. Thank you so much, everyone. Thank you, Dr. Brooks, for your time. I really appreciate it. Just to recap a little bit and touch on some of the things we may have talked about earlier on, and some of the things that I think I find really, really beneficial. The whole discussion was amazing. But if you're coming on shift or before your shift, think about those procedures or difficult cases or difficult encounters that you may go through and things that you want to do well. So, for example, you've never done a crike. In your mind, use your mind's eye. Go through that procedure. Go through it time and time and time again. Create that sim lab in your own mind so that when that case does come up, you're capable and ready to take on to it because you've done it 100,000 times in your own head. Along the same lines, when you come across a situation that was difficult, you may need to compartmentalize it, but try and come back to it later on so that you can kind of work it through your own head and not have it eat away at you later on. And if you have the opportunity to, it would be the best to debrief early on and to debrief for not only your difficult cases or your bad outcomes, but also your good outcomes so that you can kind of get a sense of how am I doing for everything and not just am I only doing these bad things? How am I doing these bad things? And I think we'll all do really well. This was an amazing talk. Thank you so much for your time. I really, truly appreciate it.
And you felt nice in 3 minutes, but took me an hour. That's pretty darn good. This could have been quicker.
No. We could easily go on for another hour. And I wanted to leave everyone with, if you don't know who Ron Burgundy is, please go watch Anchorman and you'll have a wonderful night doing so.
Yes, you will. Thank you all. I appreciate your interest.
And that wraps up a great episode from the Wellness Think Tank. Special thanks to our exclusive sponsors, U.S. Acute Care Solutions. You can reach us also on Twitter at WellnessTT. Until next time, remember that residency training should be about thriving and not just surviving.